proceed to our third and final case of the day, which is number 18-13536, M&M Realty versus Mazzoni. All right, Mr. Brannick, when you're ready. Did I pronounce that correctly?
You did, Your Honor.
Very well.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the court, I'm Steve Brannick of Brannick & Humphreys, representing the appellant M&M Realty Partners. M&M contracted to purchase a piece of property for development from the Mazzoni Trust. When the Mazzoni Trust failed to close, M&M sued for specific performance and damages, as well as suing Mr. Mazzoni, an agent of the trust, for tortious interference. The trial court granted summary judgment, saying first, we had not properly proved that we were ready, willing, and able to purchase the property, and then granted summary judgment on the tortious interference on the basis that as an agent of the trustee, Mr. Mazzoni could not be liable for tortious interference. We think there were factual issues on both of those questions, and so for those reasons, we are asking this court to reverse. Let me start with the ready, willing, and able question, because I think that's the question that the trial court spent the most time on. And here, the evidence is overwhelming in terms of providing enough evidence to get to a jury on whether M&M Realty was ready, willing, and able. M&M, as we know, was a single-purpose entity. It was owned by two individuals, Jack Morris and Joe Marino. The testimony was that Jack Morris and Mr. Marino had a net worth exceeding $500 million. So there's no question that the owners of this single purpose entity had, as the cases say, they could command the necessary resources to close.
Please go ahead, Judge Ginsburg.
Did I understand you to just say that Morris and Mazzoni individually owned M&M Realty Partners?
Morris and Maroney are the ultimate
Marino, I'm sorry, yeah.
There are several layers of
right. That was important to the district court.
These were the ultimate principals. There's no question about that.
Yeah.
And they were the ones that actually signed the contract. The court itself.
And they did so on behalf of their intermediate companies.
Yes, of course, and so that gets us to the nub of the question, because the court said if we're looking at Mr. Marino and Mr. Morris, there's no question that there's a fact issue of their ability to command the resources. So the question is,
just so we're clear, I want to make sure we're absolutely clear. I don't think the question, at least under this Capozzi case in Florida, is whether they can command the money. No doubt they can command the money.
Right.
The question is whether M&M can command them to give them the money, to give it the money, right?
Exactly.
Okay.
And so what the court did was treated Mr. Morris and Mr. Marino as if they were strangers to the transaction, in much the same way that the parties that they were relying on in Capozzi were strangers to the transaction. But I think it's very different when you have the ultimate owners, the ultimate principals of the organization, as opposed to a third party that are the ones that are going to be commanding the resources.
Although in fairness, right, in Capozzi, I mean, stranger, maybe a strong term, right? Wasn't it sort of like a rich father who was the founder and chairman or some such? I mean, it's not like he was some nameless, faceless benefactor.
Absolutely, but that's a feature that runs in common with almost all these cases. In almost all these cases either arise in the broker context of proving you're entitled to a commission, or they arise in this context. In most of the cases, someone doesn't have the resources themselves to purchase the property. And they say, well, that's not going to be a problem here because I've got a rich uncle, or my wife's friend is going to step up to the transaction. And as we see in the cases, courts are very skeptical of that. And I call those true strangers because they obviously have absolutely no legal obligation whatsoever. But I think it's very interesting to note that in those cases, the courts generally do a two-part test when they're looking at those, quote, strangers. They first look to see whether there was a legal obligation or a commitment. But secondly, they go beyond that, and the Capozzi case does this exactly. They go beyond that and see whether the so-called stranger, in fact, had the resources to close the deal. And I think that's the reason that the appellant ultimately lost in the Capozzi case, was they couldn't prove either of those things. They didn't have the evidence that the father in that case had the resources himself, and of course they didn't have the evidence of the binding commitment. But our big point is that a single purpose entity that's owned by these folks is a different sort of animal than these strangers. The only way a single purpose entity can act is through its principals and its owners. They are always the ones that are going to choose whether to fund this organization or not. They are the ones here. Certainly you can't call them strangers. They signed this contract. I guess the ultimate point is that the Mazzoni Trust got exactly what it bargained for here. It bargained with a single purpose entity that it knew was represented by Mr. Morris and Mr. Marino, and obviously knew that it was going to be Mr. Morris and Mr. Marino who were going to choose whether to fund the organization and actually close the deal or not. That's really no different from if Mr. Marino and Mr. Morris had signed the contract themselves.
Except there's no binding commitment.
Pardon me?
There is no binding commitment. Isn't that the difference?
The cases say you can show either a binding commitment, and we certainly don't have a signed piece of paper saying there's a binding commitment, but they can also say you can show that the entity that's purchasing is able to command the resources to close the deal. And if the entity itself is owned by owners...
Is that the term you want to use, command the resources? Because these entities could command the resources only to the extent that the individuals, the principals, agreed to make the resources available.
Which is exactly what they bargained for in this circumstance.
If facts had led to a situation in which Mazzoni were suing and joined not just M&M Realty Partners, but those individuals, pardon me, the intermediate LLCs, they would have the benefit of their separate corporate identity.
They would, and of course the way around that would be to have demanded guarantees from these folks as part of the negotiations. They chose not to do that. And of course the reason they chose not to do that, because this is not a practical question in this case, the M&M had the ability to walk away from this transaction at any time for any reason. So there is never going to be a breach of contract action against Mr. Morris and Mr. Marino, or against M&M Realty for that matter. So all I'm saying is that there's really no reason to treat these individuals as strangers the way they do in this case. If you look at the Capozzi case, I think, and all of the cases that we cite, there are two things that I think jump out at me as I look at them. One is that almost all these cases are decided after a trial. And that's because the courts recognize and say over and over that the question about ready, willing, and able is a factual question. Then the second thing, and this is really comes out in spades in the Capozzi case, is that they say there's no inflexible formula here. You look at all of the facts and circumstances to try to determine.
The jury found that they were ready, willing, and able to provide the money. A jury. That's
yes.
What your argument is.
A jury should have been able to decide that.
After that declaration has been made, they decide to back out because they're not committed lawfully. Then what?
Then that's the deal that they bargained for, because
bargained for the chance that they may back out.
Exactly, because M&M had the right to back out at any time.
Well, then it was illusory. Why wouldn't it be illusory? If Morris and Marino can either at their whim provide the money or not.
It's not that they could provide.
How is there any commitment in that situation?
I'm saying it's exactly what they negotiated for here in that.
Negotiated M&M, for an illusory promise?
They negotiated with M&M Realty, giving M&M Realty the
they
right to.
They needed a good lawyer is what you're saying.
I'm saying that, yeah, M&M Realty had the right to back out of this transaction for at any time for any reason. So there can't be any discussion here about this potential breach of contract action. That's not what they negotiated for. But the point that I was getting at is that the Capozzi case says that this is not an inflexible analysis. You have to look at all the facts and circumstances.
Can I ask you a question without, what I don't want you to do is to give away any sort of client confidences. But did you ever think about asking for certification of this question to the Florida Supreme Court? It just seems to me we're like up here grinding on this 30-year-old intermediate court of appeals case from state courts in Florida that arguably has some tension built into it? Is it a hard and fast rule? Does it have some flexibility built in? The Florida Supreme Court seems to suggest there's some flexibility. Are we best equipped to decide this question of sort of foundational contract law for Florida?
Well, my point is that I believe that Capozzi and the cases that it's built on have enough flexibility that your honors can apply those cases as in the way that they're read and find that this is just a routine jury fact question. But if your honors are concerned about that, I certainly would not have a problem with this case being certified to the Florida Supreme Court, because I'm absolutely convinced that the Florida Supreme Court is going to see a difference between a single purpose entity that wasn't funded here and a complete stranger to the transaction. I want to make just one, additional point, just kind of for practicality purposes here. This was never raised at the time of the closing. The reason they didn't close was because of the argument over contingencies, which you've seen in the brief. So this was not an issue. So the question is, we knew going to the closing that these folks weren't going to close. So do we have to take $5 million and stick it in this single purpose entity just to, dot all of the I's and cross all of the T's? In the real world, I think the answer to that question should be no. They've already indicated that they weren't going to close. I think it's highly ironic for them then to come in later on in the litigation and make this argument about ready, willing, and able. Of course, we didn't have the $5 million in the bank when we came to closing, because they already said that they weren't going to close. So when you look at that fact, and then you look at the fact that they chose not to close because they had a better deal elsewhere, and then you look at the facts and circumstances behind the single purpose entity, I think there's plenty of evidence in the record to support getting this thing to the jury. So I see I'm out of time, so I'll leave the rest of the issues to my brief and save the rest of my time.
Okay, great. Thank you so much. Mr. Vargas?
Good morning. My name is Mr. Vargas. I'm from Jones Foster. I'm here on behalf of the appellees, Mr. Mazzoni individually, and Mr. Mazzoni and Mr. Smith as trustees of the Mazzoni Trust. The trial court's order granting summary judgment should be affirmed on all issues. As to the specific performance and breach of contract counts, there's no dispute and no evidence that the buyer here was not ready, willing, and able under Florida law. There was no cash in hand. There was no assets and a credit rating, and there was no legally binding commitment.
So what about, you're reading that out of Capozzi, what about his point that Capozzi goes on to say, no hard and fast rule, it's got to be sort of, case by case. And in fairness, your position is sort of formalistic, isn't it?
No, Your Honor. I think my position is completely consistent with all the cases in Florida that we've relied upon.
Well, I guess I'm just asking that, let's grant the fact that Capozzi and or cases from the Florida Supreme Court may introduce some measure of flexibility into the analysis as a logical matter. Do you think your position is subject to the critique that it may seem a little formalistic?
I don't think it's formalistic, Your Honor. I think it's the rules. And I don't think that the Florida Supreme Court has said in this context that it is a flexible analysis. I understand in Capozzi there is a discussion about a flexible approach, and they've referred to that below, and they referred to that in their briefs. But I think you need to look at Capozzi closely. What they've relied upon in Capozzi is the Shell Oil case from Minnesota. And in that case, Your Honor, they cite extensively from the Shell Oil case. And the quote that they take from there is, and I'll read this. This is right from Capozzi and right from their brief. Although no precise line of demarcation between the application of the second and third divisions of the above rule can be laid down for all cases. And they put a period on that. But the reality is that quote goes on. There's actually a comma there. You need to read the rest of it, because that tells you that there is no flexibility when it comes to third-party situations. The rest of the quote from the Shell Oil case, that same sentence, goes on to say, it is clear in the light of the purpose of the rule that where the purchaser relies primarily not upon his own personal assets, but upon the proceeds of a contemplated loan or loans to be made to him by a third party, he is financially able to buy only if he has a definite and binding commitment from such third-party loaner. Even though the third party is financially able, his promise is of no avail unless made for adequate consideration. My point here, Your Honors, is that Yes, Perper talked about a flexible approach when you're looking at the purchaser trying to finance it themselves personally. But the case law has developed since 1948. In every single case, looking at the situation where a buyer is relying upon funds from a third-party source, it is an inflexible approach. There must be a legally binding commitment. You've got Taylor, you've got Kaposi, you've got Lusignan.
Are those cases, just so I'm clear, and I just don't remember them well enough, but are those cases in which the would-be benefactors, the funders, if you will, are effective owners of the buyer?
Or in Kaposi, yes.
Kaposi, the guy, was kind of like founder, chairman, and Daddy Warbucks or something, but not quite an owner, right?
Well, and that's similar to Mr. Marino in this case. He's not an owner. He's the trustee of a trust that is the member of an LLC that is a member of the purchasing LLC. And Kaposi, the funder, was the father of the children who were going to be owning the entity, the buyer entity. He was the founder of the entity. He was the chairman of the board. He was fundamentally involved in creating and operating the entity. So he was not this disinterested party that they make him out to be. And in none of the cases that they've relied upon talk about this distinction of interested versus disinterested.
Yeah, I guess the reason I wonder is whether ownership, whether direct, which we don't have here, or indirect, as Judge Ginsburg has described it, whether ownership matters, like makes some difference and distinguishes this case from others, even from Kaposi, where I grant you the guy's like all up in everybody's business, but he's not like an owner in any meaningful way. These people have like some ownership interest, even if indirect, in the ultimate buyer. And does that make a difference under Florida law? And hence me throwing my hands up and wondering whether or not I'm really qualified to decide the question or best qualified to decide the question.
It doesn't make a difference under Florida law. There's not a single case that they've cited that makes that distinction between interested versus disinterested versus owner versus non-owner.
Cases that say owners, even where owner, got to be binding commitment.
No, but
so
in every
like
case,
this is my conundrum. Like nobody has cases.
Well, all the cases that we've cited to where they're relying upon a third-party source, and whether they're owners or not owners, they're still a third-party source for the funding of the closing. The courts are very clear. There has to be a legally binding commitment. You need to know that the buyer has come to the table ready to close, and they had the full opportunity. We didn't inject this issue as like a last-minute gotcha. They made the allegation in their complaint, paragraph 30, document number 25 of the record. They made the allegation. They were ready, willing, and able. They're sophisticated developers. They understand what Florida law is. They've got good lawyers. They know what the requirements are to be ready, willing, and able under Florida law. And they didn't come to closing ready, willing, and able. They conceded at the summary judgment hearing that they didn't have cash in hand, assets, and a credit rating, or a legally binding commitment. It's not a formalistic approach. These are the rules that everybody plays by. It's predictability of contracts. It's, as Judge Rosenberg pointed out and Judge Ginsburg pointed out, it's the flip side argument. I mean, if the tables were turned and the sellers trying to enforce things here, they wouldn't be able to go after the buyers individually, the owners individually here. They're protected through two or three layers of trusts and LLCs. That's why we have the rule. If you're going to try and pursue specific performance and breach a contract to force a seller to give up their property, you need to show that you are ready, willing, and able. And they understood that. And they didn't have the evidence to support it. They made the allegation. We did the discovery. And established without any disputed issue of material fact that they didn't have the funds.
I'll just inject that. I don't think that formalism is a criticism when it comes to land transactions. I think that's the tradition. Maybe Florida's an outlier in some narrow way, but it's all about the formalities.
I agree, Your Honor, and that's what I meant when I said, you know, these are the rules. Everybody understands when you're doing commercial transactions that these are the rules. The argument's been made that this is some technicality, that we're ignoring the realities of commercial transactions. This is the reality of commercial transactions. If you're going to pursue specific performance, as they did here, you need to show that you're ready, willing, and able. And they understood that. They had the lawyers that understood that. And they made the allegation. We just did the discovery and established that they weren't. Now, as to the tortious interference argument.
Now, in fairness, and I'm going to take the guidance of my senior colleague, Judge Choflat, your opponent did not argue tortious interference during his opening.
Correct.
Judge, can he hit tortious interference here, subject to rebuttal?
Yes.
Okay, there you go. Have at it. I'm new at this, relatively new at this.
Well, with that admonition, then perhaps I'm going to stay focused on the ready, willing, and able argument. Any further questions on ready, willing, and able that I can address for the court?
It said they possessed the money in paragraph 30?
Yes.
Of the Second Amendment complaint?
Yes, paragraph 30.
It possessed the balance of the $5 million purchase price.
Correct, that the buyer possessed the balance of the $5 million. And they made the allegation.
Morris and Marino.
Correct. But we did the discovery, and there was no evidence that the buyer itself, the entity, possessed the funds, was able to command the funds. And the court did talk about able to command, and that came up originally in the Perper case. And yes, in the Perper case, the court looked at the buyer's financial wherewithal because it was an individual or individuals who were buying, and their personal finances were relevant in that instance. And were they able to command the resources? But that's not our fact here. Our facts here are a third-party loaner situation, and the cases have developed since 1948. And in the context of a third-party loaning the funds, able to command, the courts are unequivocal here and consistent throughout, it has to be a legally binding commitment.
What about, by the way, if we're talking at all about practicalities, what about your adversary's point that it was clear by the time closing rolled around that you guys had, you know, walked away, or were going to walk away, you weren't going to close, so why should they have to fund the LLC to walk into the closing walk into the closing room only to be told you're walking away?
I understand, Your Honor, and that argument was made below, and I understand it's in the briefs. The short answer to your question is that it doesn't matter that the seller made it clear that they weren't going to close.
So you don't deny that was the state of affairs?
It was the state of affairs, and I would refer the court to the Taylor case and the Capozzi case. In the Taylor case, the buyer had unilaterally canceled the contract before the closing. Didn't matter. Still had to be ready, willing, and able. Still had to have a legally binding commitment. Capozzi itself, that they rely upon so closely, they had an anticipatory repudiation claim in that case. Didn't matter. They knew going to closing that the seller wasn't going to close. They sued them for anticipatory repudiation. Doesn't matter. Courts still require that if you're going to enforce that or try to enforce it, that you must be ready, willing, and able. You need to have the legally binding commitment. So in this instance, the fact that they knew we weren't going to show up at closing, it doesn't matter. The Florida cases are clear. You still need to follow through on your burden to show that you're ready, willing, and able.
I haven't seen a Florida case with these facts, but it is not uncommon that that there's a large deposit that's going to be forfeit if the buyer doesn't show up with if the seller doesn't tender the property at closing. And that may require, as it does in one rather famous instance in Virginia, Senator Byrd's brother to move out of the house, put things in a storage van outside as though they were moving, fully aware the buyer was not going to be able to perform, go through the formalities, and then the deposit was forfeit. It's a very common sort of situation, which is avoided by doing the things that you have to do.
And you're correct, Your Honor. I mean, these may be formalities, but these are the formalities set forth in the law that everybody understands. This isn't a new issue that popped up for them. They're sophisticated buyers. They knew what the rules were. If there's no further questions, I will rest on my briefs.
Thank you.
All right,
Mr. Brannick, you've reserved 5 minutes. I would suggest that somewhere in the 5 minutes, you deal with Judge Ginsburg's very insightful question about the nature of formalities in real estate transactions.
Well, that's exactly where I was going to start. This is absolutely a formalistic rule that they're espousing, and it's not formalistic in a good way. And it's certainly not formalistic in the way that the Florida cases have addressed. So let's go back to the two key Florida cases, the Perper case and then the Capozzi case. So the Perper case is the 1948 Florida Supreme Court case. And this is what the Supreme Court says. It says, you don't have to show that you're standing outside with the money. You simply need to show that the purchaser is financially able to pay for the property and that the purchaser is able to command the necessary money to close the deal. The purchaser could command the necessary money to close a deal when its owners have that money. Then look to the Capozzi case.
Well, the owners could have contributed the money to the capital of M&M. It seems to me that the owner had two choices. Loan the money to M&M or contribute to its capital, in which M&M would have the money. It would possess the money.
If there had been a genuine issue at the time of the closing about whether M&M had the money, I would absolutely agree with you here.
You agree it's one of those two things. The owner's either going to loan the money to M&M or it's going to contribute to M&M's capital.
Absolutely.
Via its own LLC.
Right.
You agree?
Yes.
Okay. And what you're telling me is that there wasn't an issue in the case.
It wasn't. And so that's another reason why you're looking, that their argument is completely formalistic here, is because this is a lawyer-manufactured argument in litigation that had nothing to do with the real world of this transaction. And this is where I think Capozzi is so important, because Capozzi says we don't look at this formally. We look at this with flexibility, looking at all the facts and circumstances in the particular case. Now, I agree we're handicapped here and that we don't have a Florida case that relates to a single-purpose LLC. No doubt about that. All of the cases are cases like I described, where it's the rich uncle, it's the cousin, it's the father, it's the wife's best friend. They're all going to come up. I think that's very different from when you're talking about the resources of the owners to the LLC. The folks who have actually signed their name onto this contract. I think that's a very different situation. And if this court is not convinced whether that's different or not, then I think maybe certification is the right answer. But let's look at why this rule is in place in the first place. This really isn't so much a contract issue and a real estate issue. This is a damages issue. We sued for damages. And of course, to sue for damages, we have to be able to convince the jury that we were in fact damaged. Part of the way you prove to the jury that you were in fact damaged is by showing you that you really had the ability to close. So this is really just a routine factual issue over the proof of damages. This is not so much a real estate or contract question. It's just a plain old ordinary damages question. So the question is, for the jury, is this pie in the sky? Did M&M Realty really mean to purchase this property? Or was this a genuine transaction? Well, we know from the facts of this case that this was absolutely a genuine transaction. The evidence shows that other M&M entities owned by Mr. Morris and Mr. Marino spent $740,000 and 6 years trying to develop that property. To me, if we're looking at what a commitment is, that is a more serious commitment than just signing a piece of paper that says, we're going to give you the money. They spent $740,000 in 6 years.
Didn't your brother suggest that that was not in the record, that $740,000 figure?
No, the judge found it in the record. Yes. She just pointed out that was not M&M Realty, the LLC, that spent that $740,000. That was another entity owned by Mr. Marino and Mr. Morris that spent that $740,000. But to me,
it's an entity that's not in the chain of purchasers here?
Excuse me?
Where is that entity located? Is it not in this chain of purchasers?
It's not in this chain of purchasers. But to me,
it's a complete stranger.
What it focuses on is whether or not this was a genuine transaction. If another Morris and Marino entity, concede, which is a stranger to this transaction, is putting up $740,000 and spending 6 years worth of time to get the governmental approvals, that certainly seems to suggest that these owners are in fact able to and ready to and willing to fund the purchase of this deal. At the end of the day, all we are asking this court is to apply the plain language of Capozzi, which says we don't look at formalities. We look at the facts and circumstances of every case. There is no case that presents this single purpose entity thing. I think when you look at all of the facts and circumstances, there was enough to get to a jury here.
All right, thank you very much. The case is submitted, and court will be in recess until 9 a.m. tomorrow morning.